I want to read to you something that I ran across recently. It's called The Holocaust Survivor's View on Islam. A little bit of a different idea that's come across, and it's worth discussing and lead into what we want to talk about today. A man whose family was a German aristocracy prior to World War II owned a number of large industries and estates. When asked how many German people were true Nazis, the answer he gave can guide our attitude toward fanaticism. Very few people were true Nazis, he said, but many enjoyed the return of German pride, and many more were too busy to care. I was one of those who thought the Nazis were a bunch of fools, so the majority just sat back and let it all happen. Then, before we knew it, they owned us. And we had lost control, and the end of the world had come. My family lost everything. I ended up in a concentration camp, and the Allies destroyed my factories. We were told again and again by experts and talking heads that Islam is the religion of, he's not quoting him now, he's going on with his commentary, that Islam is the religion of peace, and that the vast majority of Muslims just want to live in peace. Now, although this is this unqualified assertion may be true, it is entirely irrelevant. It is meaningless fluff meant to make us feel better and meant to somehow diminish the specter of fanatics rampaging across the globe in the name of Islam. In fact, the fact is that fanatics rule Islam at this moment in history. It is fanatics who march. It is fanatics who wage any one of 50 shooting wars worldwide. It is the fanatics who systematically slaughter Christian or tribal groups throughout Africa and are gradually taking over the entire continent in an Islamic wave. It is the fanatics who bomb, behead, murder, or honor kill. It is the fanatics who take over mosque after mosque. It is the fanatics who zealously spread the stoning and hanging of rape victims and homosexuals. It is the fanatics who teach their young to kill and to become suicide bombers. The hard, quantifiable fact is that the peaceful majority, the silent majority, is cowed and extraneous. Communist Russia was comprised of Russians who just wanted to live in peace. Yet the Russian communists were responsible for the murder of about 20 million people. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. China's huge population was peaceful as well, but Chinese communists managed to kill a staggering 70 million people. The average Japanese individual prior to World War II was not a warmongering sadist, yet Japan murdered and slaughtered its way across Southeast Asia in an orgy of killing that included the systematic murder of 12 million Chinese civilians, most killed by sword, shovel, and bayonet. And who can forget Rwanda, which collapsed into butchery? Could it not be said that the majority of Rwandans were peace-loving? History lessons are often incredibly simple and blunt. Yet, for all our powers of reason, we often miss the most basic and uncomplicated of points. Peace-loving Muslims have been made irrelevant by their silence. Peace-loving Muslims will become our enemy if they don't speak up, because, like my friend from Germany, they will awaken one day and find that the fanatics own them, and the end of their world will have begun. Peace-loving Germans, Japanese, Chinese, Russians, Rwandans, Serbs, Afghans, Iraqis, Palestinians, Somalis, Nigerians, Algerians, and many others have died because the peaceful majority did not speak up until it was too late. As for us who watch it all unfold, we must pay attention to the only group that counts: the fanatics who threaten our way of life. That is, there's a truism here that unfortunately has been repeated over and over again. And that is, when something like this has occurred in the world, it begins generally with one, perhaps a few, and then it spreads and on it goes. We toured the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem on the last day or so we were there, 2 days we were there. It was sobering and told the story of the beginning of the persecution of the Jews and the implementation of the final decision, which meant that the Jews had to be exterminated, removed completely. It began, perhaps, in a way which nobody thought too much about it. Certainly Germans, perhaps, did not. It affected the Jews. There were a certain amount of rhetoric, a certain amount of propaganda coming out. Then there seemed to have been some type of restriction on the Jews. Then they began to lose their jobs in an attempt to get them to leave, and a lot of them did leave. And that was precisely what the Reich wanted them to do. They were taken out of their homes a little bit later on then, and they were herded into ghettos or camps sometimes. Their possessions were confiscated. Prior to that, books were burned. Once again, the rhetoric continued. It was later when the Germans understood that they couldn't get rid of them all. Of course, they had already blamed them for any number of things and all the problems that the Germans had, including losing World War I, never taking the blame for the fact that somebody else came along and beat the heck out of them. You don't mind me saying. They blamed the Jews for their loss. And so they understood that they couldn't get rid of them in that way, and so they came up then with the final solution that they wanted to implement, the ultimate solution to the Jewish problem, at which the German public did not know, didn't fully understand and comprehend. Oh, some few did. The Jews certainly did not know. They began to put them on trains out of the ghettos into camps that were built, or camps that were modified in order to kill them with the German efficiency that the Germans were able to do. They kept records in a way that nobody else does, and so they knew exactly what they did. We can support that simply because of the records the Germans themselves kept. They kept meticulous records, and they began to move them into places like Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Dachau. I visited the camp one time back when I was a student in college, and it was very sobering to see where they killed them, where they kept them. They lived and worked or awaited extermination or whatever happened. And then the rail lines, and then the whole thing was there. The gassing chambers where they were told they were going to be cleansed or bathed and whatever. And then they were burned. The ovens were all there. You could see it. We went inside, and it was very clear. And there was a lot more there to demonstrate that something very, very terrible was taking place. Now, the Jews, of course, went willingly. Why? Because they didn't know what was going to happen to them. The German public didn't know what was going to happen. In fact, a lot of the officers and people, soldiers, who were a part of this in the early days, when they saw that they folded, they could not stomach what was taking place, they got them out of there. They put them out on the front line somewhere, and they had to bring in people who agreed with them, agreed with their policies, and who were willing to carry out such a gruesome thing. The Jews went willingly, as I said. If they knew what was going to happen, they would have fought. They would have done something more, but they didn't. The Germans, maybe some did know, maybe some suspected, maybe some heard rumors, but they made excuses. Well, Hitler has done this for us. He has done that for us. And they had a certain German pride. And so, well, we don't know really if he does it. What can I do anyway? So others who perhaps did not know and only suspected it somehow justified it in some way. But it was the few, to start with, who agreed with the distortion and the lies about the Jews. And you had a person who was quite sinister and expert in what he did, a man by the name of Himmler. While there was certain rhetoric that was coming forth from Hitler, a guy by the name of Himmler, and then Goering, Also, their propaganda minister began, they really were able to put this into effect and implement it in a very gruesomely efficient way. So little by little, this built until the unthinkable happened. Now we say, well, wow, where did this all come from? How could it happen? What do we see today? We got to look at it today and kind of wonder, do we have anything like this being said today? Well, yes, we do. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is saying the same thing. Hitler doesn't have anything on this guy as far as what he says. How many people are with him? There are enough fanatics around. You might have to ask the question, why do you have such a wave of anti-Israel demonstration and hate over anything that Israel does? But you have very little ever happening whenever there is some type of atrocity, and there are all kinds of things going on in the Islamic world, but nobody says anything about this. But you continue to see, especially at funerals where somebody was killed. Now, we had this happen more recently with the flotilla that came in to break the Israeli blockade, and there were activists on board. In Iraq and Afghanistan, we call them insurgents, people who come in from the outside, people where if we're left up to the people themselves, maybe there would be peace. But you have a lot of other people for their own political gain, for their own political ends, for their own position in their own countries, or their own position in the world, then, or acceptance in the world, jump on this hate bandwagon and stir it up. Now, what you will find a lot of times, whenever they go to these funerals and they do their chanting, you will somehow always find a camera there. Which came first, the camera or the egg, or whatever, you know, is the camera there, and all of a sudden they see it, and here they go into their orchestrated chants. That has been known to actually happen, and they're all doing the same thing. It's hate. It's a destruction to Israel. They want to destroy Israel, not just, let's say, destroy the country as an entity, but the people of the country. This is what it has all now come down to. And of the entire Middle East, if you're an Arab, if you're a Muslim, you would tend to have some feelings or be affected by it. Now we have a nation, an entire nation, I don't know if it's an entire nation, but you have a strong incident of the nation of Turkey, who has sided with the West since 1923, now is throwing in, now with the same type of attitude that the rest of the world is taking toward Israel. Now, do they know the facts? Well, there's a lot of things people ought to know. If you've visited Israel, which some of us have done in the past year or two, you will know that Palestinians, the ones who live in Israel, get along just fine with the Israelis. You have what's called the West Bank, areas that were captured after the 1967 war. You have some problems there. But let me say, where Israel, because of the type of nation that they started, they were, you know, the Palestinians could stay there. They could live there. Where did they come from, by the way? If you do a little research, you will find that there are no such things as Palestinians prior to 1967. You'll have people with names like Jordanian names, Egyptian names, Iraqi names, Syrian names, Saudi names, who came from these countries to work there. The Jews came in, or started to come in, somewhat in more numbers after 1918, but a lot of these people came in beginning at 1918, when General Allenby defeated the armies of the Ottoman Empire in 1917, 1918, the World War I was over, and then the Jews started to come in. That's when it began. A certain economy began. People, Arabs from other nations, began to come in. That's what they were. As some would say, Jerusalem, the West Bank of the Jordan was taken over. Parts of Jerusalem that Jordan had were taken over. We were Jordanians one day. The next day, we were Palestinians. How did this happen? I didn't realize that I was a Palestinian. Somebody made this up. Somebody did it. Yasser Arafat was an Egyptian born in 1927 in Cairo, Egypt. He had a place to go to. He was not a Palestinian refugee. Surprise, surprise. Why is all this happening? Well, there is something that is taking place here. And the whole thing is then built. It is developed like Israel is just doing it to these people. Now, you saw the film clips. They're coming in with the flotilla. Nobody's against Palestinians getting what they want to get or what they need to get, but they can't get arms. And they were, 3 or 4 years ago, when we had the war by Hamas, they rained the missiles into populated areas of Israel. And so Israel says, and so Israel has to go in. They had to stop them. And what has to be done? Well, you can't let them have the missiles anymore. Who's giving them the missiles? You better look toward Iran. Where did Hamas, and why did Hamas even start the war to start with? It's suspected Iran gave the word to take the heat off of Iran and their nuclear development program. So off they went. They had a nice little war, incursions into Lebanon to deal with Hezbollah on the north, Hamas in Gaza, and then sanctions, or let's say blockades rather, to stop them from getting that. The Israelis were quite happy to let what was coming in on the ships go in. No weapons, nothing that could be remotely construed as some type of war-making material. And that's what they wanted to stop. When they boarded the ships, they were attacked. You saw the film clips yourself. It was there. It was quite clear. Now, the whole thing gets turned around. Britain, the United States of all people, with our president, begins to take a certain position now against Israel. Why? How does this get turned around? You know, there's a lot of things we could talk about, but you ought to go to Israel to see what takes place. The people can get along just fine. You know how many mosques? I mean, there are mosques everywhere in Israel. They just simply exist side by side with the synagogues. The people work together. They live together. They have an economy together. As I put in my, I wrote to you yesterday, Nazareth is 75% Palestinian. They get along. We visited Nazareth. Things get stirred up sometimes, but the people generally can get along. Why don't people just leave them alone? I think they could work this thing out. However, this is not... Anybody got any water back there? Wouldn't mind some. I think you got someone to... People can work this thing out. However, you have other people, we might even say the few, who stir things up. Well, does it sound that something is getting going again against the Israelis? This is a very interesting case in point. You know, this is not the first time it's happened in history. It has happened. It's in the Bible. And I want to go through part of that today to lead on to something else I want to say, but it makes some very interesting points. And these are not just coincidences. You need to look through it. You need to take a look at the facts as to what's happening in any situation before you draw conclusions. I've got relatives of my own. I've got a brother-in-law who just says, look what Israel is doing. They ought to get out of there, how terrible the Israelis are, this, 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 and that. You hear it. Some of you may have your own relatives. Some, I don't know if it's, what kind of opinion you hold, but you ought to look at the facts as to what is taking place here and why people are in the situation that they're in. Now, in the book of Esther, I want to point something out to you, and hopefully we can see that we've got a, this is not something that is only just now happening. It's a book we generally don't quote from, but I want to stay with this quite extensively today to simply point out to you what did happen to the Jews at some time in history. Now, we wonder where a lot of this has actually come from. Why why do we have, it seems, such antagonism against the Jews? I'm here to suggest that there is a reason for it. And the reason is not because you're going to have to lay on them the death of Jesus Christ. Oh, they had a part. I mean, that's where Christ came to. They were his own people. The Romans had a part. You and I don't take that position that any one particular group of people are necessarily responsible. The position that we take is that this was according to God's determinate will. He said it was to be done. It so happened the Jews were there. They had a hand in carrying it out. So did the Romans. But in fact, we all had a part in killing Jesus Christ, did we not? Yes, we do. That's the position that we would take. We're not here to lay it off and blame it on someone else, but here we have a situation where the Jews were under attack long before Christ ever came. And we had the same thing going on. I want to turn to the book of Esther in chapter 3. And the story is at the time of, let's say, the Jews who are still in Persia chose to live there. Not all of them went back to Jerusalem after the first, I believe it was the second king of Persia, actually let him go and go back and allow them to resettle in Judea and to rebuild Jerusalem. And we know that from Ezra and Nehemiah and the stories that were there. There were Jews who stayed up around the area, well, where of the Persian capital, Susa, and then, of course, throughout the entirety of the empire, there were Jews because they had been scattered there, and so a lot of them simply remained. Chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Now, what had happened before? The first couple of chapters tells us about a young Jewish girl who lived there with her uncle, Mordecai, who became queen of all things, of this king, the greatest man in the world at that time, a man who ruled over vast territories, and from all the way from Ethiopia, as it says, to India. He had subdued all these people and all down into North Africa. He was the ruler of, one might say, that Eastern civilized world at that time. And here we're breaking into it. Esther becomes queen, and it says after these things, then another part of the story, but it sets it up to show why Esther is there, a young Jewish girl. Promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all princes who were with him. So here was a person, then, by the name of Haman, the Agagite. Now, who would that have been? You look back 500 or 600 years earlier, and you find a person by the name of Agag. Actually, that wasn't his name. That's what he was. He was a king of the Amalekites. Who were the Amalekites? The Amalekites were descendants of Esau, and whenever they came out of Egypt, Israel was coming out of Egypt, the Amalekites attacked them from behind and killed, ostensibly, young people, old people, the stragglers who couldn't defend themselves. And Moses said, left word, these people are to be dealt with when you become a nation. Don't let that go. These people are out. They are against Israel. Out right from the very beginning, they made it clear what they wanted to do. Now, so Saul becomes the first king. Samuel comes along and he says, remember what we've got to do. We got to deal with the Amalekites. And so Saul goes down, slays the Amalekites, wipes them out for the most part, not all of them as we're going to see, and takes who? Agag. Agag is their king, or the king. That's what the king of the Amalekites were called. He was an Agag. Saul did not kill Agag as he should have done. And Samuel comes along and says, why haven't you dealt with him? And Samuel has to finish him off himself, as the story goes. Now we have 500 or 600 years later, we have an Agagite, a descendant of the royalty of the Amalekites, who had advanced himself to the point where he was over everybody serving the king in the empire of Persia. Now, and all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai, Esther's uncle, a Jew, would not bow or pay homage. And the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily, he would not listen to them. And they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. He's not going to bow down to an Amalekite after what they did. And Mordecai refused to do it. Then Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage. Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. It was a political thing. For they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Oh yeah, he wanted Mordecai, all right. That was a personal thing. But there was also an issue with Haman. I want to get rid of the Jews too. This is very, very interesting here. Haman hatches a plot, verse 8. He says to the king Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those who do the work, and to bring it into the king's treasures. And so the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Whoever wrote the book of Esther really wants to make it clear what is taking place here. Letters were sent out, it says in verse 13, by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews. Folks, do we have genocide here? Nothing new. We have genocide. Both young and old, little children and women in one day. So there was going to be a time it was set. It was all going to happen in one day. And to plunder their possessions and so on. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned what had happened, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, went into the midst of the city, cried out with a loud and bitter cry. Okay, and then, of course, Esther doesn't see Mordecai for a while. She wants to know what's going on. The eunuch goes and sees him, brings back word. She says, what do you want me to do? And Mordecai sends back this message to Esther. So they told, verse 12, So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in all the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent, At this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another source, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And you've heard that quoted a number of times, haven't you? Who knows whether you have come to this to a place like this now at this time? And she began to see that she had to do something. So she says, gather all the Jews, tell them to fast for me, and I will fast likewise, me and my maids who are with me, and then I will go into the king and I will see what I can do. And so she, after the third day of fasting, she goes in to the king, and there's Haman, and you're not supposed, the king hadn't sent for her for 30 days, and for her to do this could mean death for her, because she goes in without being summoned. And but the king holds out his scepter. She is accepted. Come on in. He says, Queen Esther, how nice to see you. What can I do for you? I'll give you anything you want up to half of your kingdom. And then she says, let me put on a banquet for you. So they have a banquet. She says, what can I do for you up to half my kingdom at the banquet? She says, come to another banquet. She's kind of, she's playing this thing out, okay? And so then he on the second day, the banquet of wine, chapter 7, verse 2, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done. And then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Notice the word here. Verse 4, annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy would never compensate for the king's loss. So, he says, who would do such a thing? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, he's sitting right there, Haman. And then Haman realizes, oh, we got a problem here. You know, he's in trouble all of a sudden. The king gets up. He is so mad, he can't even talk. He goes out of the room and to try to compose himself or think or whatever, because he realizes he's in a dilemma. And in the meantime, Haman comes and throws himself on Esther in a very inappropriate way, begging for forgiveness. The king walks in, sees him in that position, and says, get this guy out of here. And the guards come in, drag him out, and say, we're going to do something to him. And Esther, he says, what do you want me to do, Esther, with him? He says, hang him on the gallows that he has already prepared for Mordecai, my uncle. Done. So she says, here's what else we can do. We have got to deal with the situation. The decree has gone out. My people are going to be attacked and destroyed. So Mordecai is brought in. Mordecai says, we've got to send out another decree. They have to defend themselves. Tell them they're free, legal to do, to defend themselves from any attack. Now, what you got to understand is this. How did all this get going? Why do you have so many people out here then who are going to go against the Jews? Why do you have so many people are going to go along with this guy Agag to annihilate the Jews who are in all of the king's provinces? Somebody had to say something. Somebody had to spread the terrible things about the Jews. They had to lie about them. It had to show that these people are bad, bad people. They are against the laws of the land, which they weren't, by the way. And so they wrote out immediately. The order was given. The other princes and the satraps and the governors had to now change their position. They had to go along with this all the way from, as it says, from India to Ethiopia. 127 provinces, verse 9 it says, and to every province, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And so that was done. and from the palace in Susa. And the people of Susa, the rest of the people, rejoiced. They couldn't understand why it was happening in the first place. Why did this command ever go out? It says earlier they were very dismayed. I'm talking about the general public. Now, when the command came that the Jews could fight for themselves, then they were very happy and they rejoiced. I'm not reading that to you, but that's a part of the story as to what took place. Now, Haman was hanged along with his 10 sons. They were all in it together. A lot of people were killed over it, showing that they were also enemies of the Jews. You had a real thing going here. Haman just couldn't do this by himself. What I'm simply saying is this: Haman had already done his evil work. He had stirred up sufficient numbers of the people to carry this out. He just needed it to be legal. Esther speaks out to remain silent. We have evidence, so much evidence, of the conspiracies simply against the nation of Israel. In Psalm 83, for instance, let me just very quickly point this out to you, where David, this is almost a prophetic psalm in the way it's laid out. You'll see what I mean in a moment. Psalm 83. It says, here's David who says, "Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head." This is what they really do. They just hate God. "They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.'" Now here's David writing about this. "For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria has also joined with them, and they have helped the others." Did you count how many there were? 10. 10 nations. That could be interestingly prophetic. Just thought I'd mention that. And of course, he says, deal with them. And he mentions some of the times when God dealt with the enemies of Israel in the past, Midian, Sisera, Jabin, and so on. And who said, "Let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession." And here David perhaps is giving a prophetic psalm here. But once again, he's making the point. The enemies of Israel are always there. And they're always going to come against Israel. One might say, why is that happening? These are God's people. But how do they do it? What do? They are confederate. They're in league with one another. How do you, how do you get something like that started? How do things get going with such hatred? How does such propaganda go out in such amounts in order to form such a force or people grouped together as one people from many nations, as we see here, and as we also see today, many nations, as if by cue, everything that happens, and doesn't matter where you go, you can go to Yemen, you can go to Syria, you can go you can go right into Gaza, for instance. You can go now, more recently, which hasn't been happening before, right into Turkey, where some of these people were from, who were killed in their attempt to lift the blockade. Almost on cue. There it is. Happens all the time. The same thing over and over again. You have hatred being poured out. As I said, it's almost like it is orchestrated. But something has to start it. Something has to say it. In Germany, one man started it. You remember the images? I do. I've seen the film clips of Hitler. He's up there speaking. His temple and his top part of his jaw quivering, you know, and pulsating. His mouth open, just the mouth. Out it comes. Again and again and again. And he stirs things up. He says things. It always comes from somebody. Somebody says it. Somebody articulates it. Somebody expresses it. And something starts in a person's, first of all, a person's mind, a person's heart. And they develop this thought, this idea, and they begin to get other people with it. That's how it grows. And it's not a very difficult thing to understand, but it's not a mystery. I want you to notice a couple of places. There was a tactic right from the very beginning in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14, where you can see this type of thing happening here. This was perhaps, well, I will say, this is the beginning of it. And the tactic generally has not stopped. The same tactic is being used. It says in verse 12 of chapter 14, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations? For you have said in your heart." I want you to notice where it all begins. Somebody had to contemplate this. Somebody had to develop these thoughts, these ideas in their minds. "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." And so here now we begin to see what's behind it. "I will exalt my throne." He had a throne. Now he wants to exalt his throne above the stars of God. "I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds." Shows you kind of where he was. "I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit." And so we begin to see the beginnings of it. You begin to see what he said. You begin to see that he had thoughts toward God which were not good. And he began to say things. I'll show you that he did in just a moment. I know that he did. Let's turn over to Ezekiel 28, the other place where we see the internal workings of the mind of the one who became an adversary. Chapter 28, beginning in verse 12. "You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God." He's not talking about Adam, folks. This is a type or a takeoff of the king of Tyre who did do similar things. But this is someone else. "Full of wisdom, perfect in beauty." He's not talking about a human being here. "Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, etc. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created." Huh, he was created. As we see here a couple of times, he says, "You were the anointed cherub." He's certainly not talking about Adam, who was in the garden, he and Eve. Adam was created from the dust. Eve was created from a rib. They were the only two. He's not talking about those two. He's talking about somebody else who was created. Everybody else after that were born. He wouldn't speak of them this way. Now, "You are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you." In other words, that's what God made him, gave him that position, that importance, when as a part of his creation. "You were on the holy mountain of God." He was right there with God. "You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones," showing that here's a very important place. That's all that means. "You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created." till iniquity was found in you. Now, by the abundance of your trading, he had a lot of dealings with a lot of things going on. You became filled with violence within, and you sinned, and therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, or removed your power that you had before, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones, and from then on he was found on earth. After that, still with his throne, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Now, what kind of wisdom are we talking about here? And how was a person's heart lifted up? Now, he had a wisdom. He was given wisdom. He was full of wisdom, as it says. Now he's corrupted his wisdom. Now, what kind of wisdom are we talking about? Do we have that described anywhere in the Bible? Let's turn over to James. We begin to see some of what he did. James, the third chapter, in verse 13. James addresses this point. He says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom." Now you have the wisdom, then, the way it's supposed to be, has one of its characteristics as meekness. This is good. On the other hand, there's another kind of wisdom, a wisdom that is perverted. He still had his wisdom. Now he perverts his wisdom. "But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your heart, do not boast and lie against the truth." Now we have envy. We have self-seeking in a person's heart. Okay? This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic, it says. This is a different kind of wisdom. "For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there." So it's a wisdom, then, that does not produce peace. It's a wisdom. It's not the wisdom from above, verse 17, "but the wisdom that is from above is first pure." What are we talking about here? We're talking about a wisdom. One might say worldly wisdom. One might say political wisdom. You might even call it that way. We use the word political, and that has to do with concerning the promotion of oneself, rather than what is right, just, and good, and for the good of all. It's corrupted wisdom, wisdom that is not godly. Wisdom, one might say, we use the word Machiavellian, do we not? Showing that there is a political tone to the whole thing. That is, cunning enough to be able to promote your own self-interest while making it look like you are promoting the general good. Would you say that's a fair definition? What do you see today? You have politicians, that's why we use the word. They have to promote themselves. They have to be very cunning. They have to use worldly wisdom in order to promote what they're going to be, what they're going to have, the power that they can have if they are elected. But they disguise that by talking about how much good they're going to do for other people. I think that's a pretty good definition of the word political. All right, here's where it started. And this is corrupted wisdom. It is not godly. Now, with this, he was able to convince a third of the angels. He didn't stand up and say, "You know, I'm an evil angel." He didn't say that. He says, "You got to understand, we're doing this for the greater good. We're doing this for your good." And that's political. Chapter 12, verse 4, "His tale drew a third of the stars of heaven, and he threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. He was able to convince a third of the angels. He was able to talk to them. He was able to convince them that his way was right. Two-thirds, he couldn't convince. It begins with a few. Other people are starting to be convinced. They buy into it. Other people, then more people throw into it, to the point where he thinks he can do something about it. Now he can ascend to the throne of God. You see, it's something that God really hates when this sort of thing goes on. God wants to have a relationship with his people that are open, that's transparent, that's clear. You know God, he knows you, you know exactly where you stand. It's a wonderful relationship to have. And this behind-the-scenes thing where people operate that way is, one might say, Machiavellian. It is political. It's backroom. It's the way the world is not supposed to be operating. I mean, the world does operate, and they learned it from the devil. Proverbs chapter 6. In verse 16, these six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. Lucifer was the first one to sow discord. He was the one to affect his fellow angels. He was the first one to use the cunning wisdom, the devilish wisdom, in order to get people to go along with him. In Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 28, a perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. If it's got to be whispered, does it have to be said at all? In an ideal community, it should be out there. It's a marketplace, isn't it? You are who you are. You're accepted. You should have nothing to fear. It says an ungodly man digs up evil, and it is on his lips like a burning fire. You cannot help to do that. Back to Revelation chapter 12, we begin to see the tactics of the very first one who did this, and the one who was able to spread, to open his mouth and spread it. Revelation 12 is where we're going to spend the rest of this message today, because we're coming to something that's very important to all of us. Revelation chapter 12. It says, there was a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head, a garland of 12 stars. And then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. Now here's showing him the devil as a beast, a ruler, a dragon. Then, who is oppressing other people. Now, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven, threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. We know this was Jesus Christ. And it only speaks of the woman then who's giving birth to the male child, because this is why he came. He came for the church. He loved the church. He gave himself for the church. He died for the church. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, and they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now, when was this? There was a time when the true followers of Christ had to get out of the control and the clutches, as it were, of the Roman Empire. In 325 AD, when Constantine adopted Christianity as his religion, and he wanted any controversies within the Christian religion to be resolved, and so he began to call conferences, one in 325, another one around 380, in which some pretty bad doctrines began to come into place. They had already begun keeping Easter rather than Passover, and it was now the Church of the Roman Empire. Therefore, they had their place now by rule of law of the Roman Empire, and those who would not and could not accept what was going on in the church at that time, and who were being forced to, because a decree came out, says you cannot even own houses, you cannot have meeting places. And so these people had to leave. And so they went up to northern Italy, up toward the Alps. They went into Switzerland. They went into France. They went into the Caucasus. They went into areas where they simply had to live, and they stayed there for 1,260 years, a day for a year in prophecy, until the hold of the Catholic Church began to be broken. And under the Reformation movement that began with Martin Luther. And then you begin to see people who observed the Sabbath, now quite openly, first in England, and then moving on into America. And they begin to come out, as it were, of the wilderness. And the truth began to spread. And more people began to accept it. Now, there's a lot of parts of the story I'm not going to get into, but suffice it to say that the church, the woman, had to go into the wilderness for that period of time. Now we have verse 7. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with a dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. Now we have a different time. As we move on down a timeline, as it were, in Revelation chapter 12, we have now a war breaking out. And they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So it's a time when the devil or his angels had no further place in heaven. This time, if it's not, hasn't already happened, it's something that will indeed happen, but for now, the people of God, so far as we know, are being accused in front of God's throne. We know when God called the meeting of the sons of God, meaning the angels, who was there? The devil was there. And so God had a conversation with him in front of everybody about Job. And he was going to do something, of course, unbeknownst to the devil, but he was going to work out his purpose. But so here's a time, however, and we see in a few verses that this is the end time, because it's a time when the devil has a short time. Let's read on. There was not a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was cast to the earth, and his angels, notice, his angels, those who believed him, those who were affected by his rhetoric, his reasoning, the evil that was in his heart, were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. The general time is when this is all happening. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. So that's what he's been doing. Now he has no more place, and he doesn't accuse them any longer. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. How else will you do it whenever you're accused? You don't get in the boxing ring with the devil and spar it out with him. You simply call upon the blood of the Lamb. And by the word of their testimony, you have to know the truth, as Jesus did without being affected by what he might say or how he might try to deceive you. And they did not love their lives to the death. Now, once you do that, what else can he do? He can't hurt you any longer. If you're prepared to die, there's nothing he can do. It's over. And that's why he left Christ. He's ready to die. I can't tempt him if he's willing to give his life. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and to the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath. More so than before, because he knows he has a short time. Once again, this tells you the time element of this war that will again break out in heaven. All of this happens now. Now there's something else that takes place that we ought to take a look at, perhaps a little bit of a new look at what's going on here. Then the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, the church, identified earlier in the chapter. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, similar to before, for the place of, or a time of protection, to her place, it says, where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. A couple of things we ought to notice here. The word in the King James says the face, prosopine. What's in the face? A mouth. Out of the mouth comes what? Deception, but deception at this point in a way that you've never heard before. All guns are going to be turned toward the church. Then somehow hurt the woman. But notice, it doesn't say from the presence of the dragon. It doesn't say from the presence of Satan. It doesn't say from the presence of the devil. It says the presence of the serpent. The serpent is the cunning one. That's his name here at this point in the prophecy. The same as he was back in the Garden of Eden. The deception, the lies, the insinuations that he began to speak to Adam and Eve, or to Eve more specifically, and really got her into it. Then now the serpent is doing it again. So the serpent, as it says, spews water out of his, where? His mouth. Where else does it come? Ideas, concepts, thoughts, propaganda, half-truths, outright deceptions, emotional things, hatred starts coming out of his mouth, and it's formidable. It is so formidable that the church has to have this kind of protection. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying this is not a literal place of safety. All I know, it's not Petra. I will tell you that. Don't even think of going there, living in caves where only people were buried and nobody ever lived there before, because you're going to be living with dead people on your floor in 45 degree heat. Now, with no water. So we have a little bit of a problem here. I'm not saying there isn't a place. It seems to say there is. But it has to be removed from the face. The face, that serpent, from which he has now a presence or a face, from which flows horrible, horrible deception, which is so great that the church has to be taken from that kind of thing. They can't. Even the church has a problem being able to stand up to it. And God says, you need to be nourished. How? Spiritually, of course. And you need to be gotten away from that. She's not going to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth. It's almost as if nature itself, I don't know how to interpret that, but nature itself then speaks loudly enough to overcome the terrible deception and the untruths that are being spoken, and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon spewed out of his mouth. Again, that's where it starts. It comes from a person's mouth. It comes from the inside. It's what they say. They wage war with what they say in their mouth. They stir up people. You'll find that demons came out of the mouth in Raymond and chapter. Let's say there was some came out of the demon's mouth in Revelation chapter 9 that stirred up the most devastating war that the world will ever see. They just stir it up, and they get people stirred up, and they go to war, and they hate, and they're willing to kill, and they want to be killed, and they will be killed, and they want to in turn kill. And the dragon was enraged with a woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And these people are going to have to learn to resist that. They're going to have to learn, too, that their defense or overcome him with the blood of the Lamb, which it doesn't say. But it says earlier, if that's what you're going to do, that you have to use that. You have to use the blood of the Lamb. You're going to have the word of his testimony and so on to be able to do that. It's going to be a horrible time. But this is why the church has to be taken to the wilderness again, certainly for her physical protection. That's the way we've always understood it. But I want to tell you this. It has to be taken because of its the protection from the face of the one who deceives. It's going to be so formidable that the church has to be removed from this. And don't think that somehow you and I have the power or the ability to withstand it. The danger is accusation. The danger is deception. The danger will be lying signs and wonders. He's going to pull out all these guns against the church. It will probably be started by a few. Let me ask you something. In 1995 and prior to that, how did an entire church be switched over from what it knew to be the truth? How many people did this? You know the names. You can count them. The few. That's what it takes. That's all it takes to get started. Now, what you're going to find is that certain things are going to get started. It's going to be basically a removal of God from everything. You're already seeing it. The name of God, the power of God, accepting God as one's leader, as one's ruler, to where you have situation ethics. This has already happened, but you're going to see this more and more to where it's going to be so very difficult for even the people of God to sustain their zeal, to sustain their involvement with Jesus Christ, their head and their leader, in such a way in order to be protected from this. That's why he has always got to be, must be, seen to be, and in practical ways, the head of the church and the head of every man and the head of every individual in the church. This is what the way the Bible says it. Now, we ought to ask, do we do this? Are we into it yet? We need to think about this. In Matthew 24, let me show you something here, where Christ himself indicates that there is deception. To such an extent that even the elect could be deceived. Verse 20, pray that your flight be not in the winter and the Sabbath, for then will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. We read about that in Revelation 12, where the devil comes down and says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. Here's your great tribulation. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh should be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Here's the protection here. The days are going to be shortened. Now, if anyone says to you, look, here is Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christ, false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. So now you have, once again, deception on a scale that the Church of God, or the world for that matter, has never seen it before, never experienced it. I know some of us think we're pretty smart. How do I know that? Take my word for it. Some of us think we are. You can't stand against this. You won't be able to. And you're going to have to rely upon God to get you through this. And you're going to have to see Him as the one who is constantly involved in your life to get through this. It'll be a combination of heresy, accusation, tribulation, signs, and wonders. So much so that even the very elect will begin to doubt if what they believe is even possible. Anybody ever been in that position before? Where you entertain the idea, maybe I could be wrong in what I believe. I think a lot of people have. And come back from the brink, thankfully. But a lot of people haven't. The seeds of this are all around you. You will need every bit of God's help. But we see how it's happening. Whole countries, whole communities, whole races of people then begin to change, begin to get caught up in things led by the few. Whole concepts come into organizations. Whole departures of a way of life start to prevail. And you don't know how it happens, but it does happen. We have to be ever vigilant, brethren, ever watchful. Appreciated Sal's sermonette. We do need to stand. And we do, of course, need to make a difference because of the times that we're in. But it doesn't take much. I wanted to point that out to you. We do live in dangerous times. Thanks for coming today. We'll see you next week.